And that's part of what went into the role to socialism is painted black, because there's been a crisis afoot for a long time in the world. And there's been a crisis that really began to deepen after the Second Imperialist War, referred to most often as World War II. But it was a war, it was an imperialist war. It was a war that was fought to redivide the world. They were all bandits in that war. They were all thugs in that war. And of course, we get taught that Hitler was the bad guy in the war, but the truth of the matter is that Churchill made Hitler look like a Boy Scout. I mean, Churchill was the Prime Minister of England, and England presided over what they boastfully said was a world upon which the sun, an empire upon which the sun never set. And Hitler was just trying to get a piece of the action that the British already controlled. So most of the world was dominated by colonial white power. America dominated the colonies internal to America, you and me. England dominated at the time, going to the Second Imperialist War, England dominated a quarter of the world's population and territory by itself. And that doesn't even include what France and Germany and Belgium and the rest of them controlled. And so this war was fought to redivide the world, the Second Imperialist War. But with this war, enough space was created because of the imperialists involved in the fighting among themselves, that we began to see the serious sharpening of the struggles of oppressed peoples around the world for national liberation.
That's right.
So 1947, India became nominally freed. In 49, China. In the 50s, we saw all kinds of stuff happening throughout Africa, and the Middle East. 59, Cuba. 1960s, the Vietnamese Revolution. And the 60s, the Tupamaras in Uruguay, and again, the Sandinistas in the 60s, just revolutionary struggle happening all over the world in the 60s, going into the 70s. Remember in 1979, the Iran, where the people overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979, it was a fundamental crisis. They began to define it as a crisis. The guy whose name is Brzezinski. Anybody here familiar with Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor for James Earl Carter? Yes. Brzezinski is the one who created the modern jihad. He's the one who created Osama bin Laden as a means by which to sucker the Soviet Union into Afghanistan, to wipe the Soviet Union out of, destroy it in Afghanistan, to create its own Vietnam. Well, Brzezinski characterized in 1970s, he was talking about an arc of crisis. Struggles were happening everywhere, you know, from Iran all the way over to El Salvador. People were fighting for and winning their freedom, etc. And this is the crisis. And the base of the crisis is that these are struggles which were taken away from the imperialism that was born of slavery, that was born of the theft of other people's resources, and created a world system and economy off of that, is now in struggle to try to maintain its grip on the world to fight in a fight for its life. And so that's the basis of the kind of crisis. When Carter tried, but the U.S. was weakened very seriously politically, when Carter came to power, if you remember, this was following shortly after the Nixon had lost power, and the people that really around the world and in this country were disgusted with U.S. electoral politics. And Carter was the guy who came forward as a born-again Christian. He was a born-again Christian from the South. I would never lie to you.
Trust me.
As opposed to Nixon, and he was the one who built a foreign policy based on what? Human rights. And he was the one who put a Negro in charge of American affairs of the United Nations in the form of Andrew Young from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And he was the one also who, with Brzezinski, that created this situation in Afghanistan. He was the one that that armed, trained, funded the and helped give direction to the modern jihad, this Arab fundamental Arab movement that destroyed the Soviet Union, and that's we are told is responsible for 9/11. And so the U.S. was weakened, and so Reagan, and what helped Carter, and what helped not Carter, but the struggle to reposition America, and the U.S. was also weakened because the North American population didn't have a stomach for war, because Vietnam had kicked its ass. And this thing referred to as the Vietnam syndrome, where this peasant-based society, starting off with bricks and sticks, ended up defeating U.S. imperialism. This whole notion of the old flag never touched the ground, boy. Not only did it touch the ground, if it didn't touch the ground, it was because they were running too fast carrying it, you know. But the Vietnamese helped them and made them timid about fighting and jumping on other countries, and then the political fallout from Nixon, and then Reagan came along. And Reagan came along attacking all of us, attacking the whole revolutionary process in the world, attacking Mexicans, Africans, everybody. And he came to rescue America, to make America. He was the white guy on the white horse. And he was helped tremendously because of the so-called hostage crisis. Do you remember the hostage crisis? Mm-hmm. And they played the hostage crisis just like they did 9/11. And you had to have been here to see it, because some of you weren't here. Mm-hmm. 1979 is when that occurred. And when the people in Iran captured the U.S. embassy in Iran and the spies in there, and held them for a long time, and there was outrage in the country, and the little yellow ribbons went up everywhere. That was before they had the little magnetic thing that you can stick them on the column here that you find now. And every day, you know, another day, U.S. hostages is held. U.S. was quote-unquote humiliated because this nothing kind of country was able to hold their forces, and they couldn't do anything about it. And Reagan came. And Reagan, you know, charged Carter with letting them hold our hostages and giving away our canals, talking about the Panama Canal, you know, and attacking the welfare queens and all the oppressed peoples, and doing a whole campaign against oppressed peoples around the world. And white folk voted for Reagan to make America good and pure and powerful again. And I was in Nicaragua when Reagan was inaugurated. And one of the first foreign policy articulations that came from Reagan's Secretary of State. It was very interesting because his Secretary of State was a general, Alexander Haig.
That's right.
Not a career diplomat, but a general, which reminds us of this time, doesn't it?
Mr. Powell.
Of Colin Powell, which was a statement about what his foreign policy was going to be. Uh-huh. And Haig made the statement that henceforth, these struggles, that so-called struggles for national liberation, are going to be called what they are, and they're going to be struggles for war, terror, they're going to be called terrorists, and the people who support them are going to be characterized as supporters of terrorism. This was under Reagan. You remember who Reagan's vice president was? George Herbert Walker Bush. Now, we were told then that George Herbert Walker Bush was the moderate imperialist. But the policy is being pursued right now by his son have an eerie resemblance to the ones that were being pursued by Reagan at the juncture. And it's in the policies that were being pursued to try to rescue an imperialism in crisis. And in order to do that, they needed to win the North American population to solidarity with that effort.
That's right.
And so this quote-unquote crisis with the 9/11 gave them an opportunity to do that, but I think they're fighting a losing battle. I don't think you can put the genie back in the bottle.
Well,
I think that the oppressed peoples around the world are determined to be free, and we need to jump into the fray and that we have to be involved in revolutionary activity. I'm convinced there is no future. If you are students here, then one of the purposes of this school is to seduce you.
That's right.
And to convince you that somehow you get smart enough and anglicized enough, and somehow you'll work your way out of him because you're really not like the rest of them. You understand? The objective is to seduce you. And but I'm saying that where we are now gives us access to certain kinds of resources that our people ordinarily don't have in the barrios and in the colonial communities that we live in. And you know, they're all around us. And if we work with the decent premise, and I think I just gave you one in terms of the origin of our misery and growing immiseration. If we work with a decent premise about that, and I think that we can begin to do the kind of intellectual work, not separate from other work, but certainly we can begin to do the intellectual work that we allow us to engage in this battle of ideas. And we don't have to be intimidated anymore by the rot that the colonialists putting forth in their pundits. We don't have to be intimidated by that. We know we can actually walk around with a bit of arrogance in terms of knowing who we are and who we are contending with and how they came to be where they are. And the thing is that we can work in concert with all the other people on earth who want to be free. Everybody can do that. You understand? It's not just something that we can do. I mean, the thing is that it takes us in motion to give other people the option. They recognize that they have an option. Because our position is imperialism, you can live without it. And I think that's what we have to win. We win our own people to a hatred of imperialism, to a hatred of the humiliation that we have to go through every day in our lives, and help them to understand it in a good way, and arm them with the information and with the theory that will explain it to them, so that this demoralization that most of our people suffer from, the lack of confidence that most of our people suffer from, national lack of confidence that we suffer from, everywhere, help them to understand this. And because I would tell you this, the imperialists know that that this crisis is deepening. I have even read a book written by a man named Samuel Huntington, who is a professor at Harvard University, who is one of the thinking representatives of the ruling class. And he wrote a book, one of the first was called Clash of Cultures. Wasn't that what it was called?
Yes.
Clash of Cultures.
Clashes
of Civilizations, yeah. And San Diego is in the book, one of the early parts of the book. And you were in the book, you Mexicans, because you had the audacity to walk around carrying the Mexican flag. And you should have been carrying the red, white, and blue. And this was clear evidence of the contradiction that they were seeing. The fact of the matter is, this question of identity is becoming something that's really extremely important to all of us. Because we have been named and defined in the image of our oppressors. And so then we're finding our own feet, our own identity, and it is helping to arm us to struggle against this oppressor that we have. And so we have a responsibility. We can be seduced, but I will tell you this thing. There's nothing about us that makes us so much smarter than our fathers and mothers and our grandmothers and grandfathers. There's no way that you can trick this system into freeing you. It understands what its interests are. The question is, do we understand what our interests are?
Right,
and if we are serious about being free, we have to become revolutionaries. We have to become revolutionaries. This system must be dismantled if we are going to be free, if our children are going to be free. I think that we would be totally irresponsible to leave this planet knowing that either we have children or going to have children sometime, and that we haven't done anything to guarantee that their future will be shaped by us and not by our oppressor. Right. And I keep hearing frequently people say, well, you know, it might not change in my lifetime, but the next generation, why would we leave this to another generation? My position is, in my lifetime, this thing had to be brought down so that we can live and the people on the planet Earth can live, and others who want to can get a choice, can make a choice to stand on the right side of history. So I don't have the book, but that's the kind of stuff that was in it. And by June, there will be another book that we'll have out. And I thank you, and if we want to open it up, we can do that. Thank you so much for your patience.
chance to say your ideas, questions, concerns, disagreements. That's the essence of the space, that not all of us have to agree on everything. Debate, analysis, questions, disagreements are welcome, so.
We must,
that's
if we have
right.
them. We can't grow unless we do. I can't grow unless you do. I might be wrong about everything I said. Somebody needs to tell me.
I just wanted to highlight very quickly, and very important for us to all of us to recognize the importance of Chairman O'Malley's visit here to San Diego. He just traveled around the world in the last couple of weeks and months, South America, Africa, and Europe, if I'm not mistaken. And so we're not just happen to be by mistake here at Groundworks and just be walking by and be able to catch Chairman O'Malley. It's something very significant, very important for him to be here with us and sharing his ideas. So I just wanted to highlight that because it hadn't come out yet.
Yes. If you think there's a failure in historical materialism to describe history, what do you think would be a better analysis? Has the African Socialist Party come up with one, or?
I believe in historical materialism. Okay. I am a historical materialist. In fact, I used it to find out that Marx was wrong about some things.
Okay.
And I think that, the method of investigation analysis can be no better than the information that you use. And I thought that Marx was influenced by, I made the point that with society, the one who's doing the investigating, the scientist, that was a problem, I think, with Marx, who constantly referred to the rest of the world outside of Europe as the uncivilized people and things like that. And we were addressed as simply factors significant only in how we impact the development of Europe that was being characterized, however, as human development or human society when it was essentially European society and European development.
Chairman, would you give us a working definition of class in primitive petty bourgeoisies?
Well, the class question is kind of complicated. But class is groups of people, generally speaking, identified by their relationship to production in society, means of production in society. And some of the people who are owners and controllers of the means of production are the people who would refer to as the ruling class. That is the bourgeoisie. And then there are petty owners, smaller owners, who are referred to as the petty bourgeoisie. These are not people who own and control the means of production, the things which are necessary for producing value and wealth. These are not people who own and control that. But these are small owners, shop owners, not necessarily small shop owners, sometimes larger shop owners, et cetera. And then there are other strata who might be considered part of the petty bourgeoisie, what some people refer to as the middle class, the small owners. Sometimes these are strata that might be involved, like university professors, etc. Then of course the working class, people who produce value. But so that's how, generally speaking, the classes are defined, Marx's definition, more or less, of classes. The problem that we have here is that you have the definition of classes and their relationship to the means of production without considering the role in production that whole bunches of human beings play. For in Detroit, used to be not that significant anymore, where you had like an auto industry, major auto industry located in Detroit. And at the point of production, you had all kinds of workers there who were exploited. We say exploited because they did not receive the full value of their labor. You understand? That's what exploitation is. And they were seen through the most Marxist analysis as the key forces in the contest with the bourgeoisie. The problem is that before they could put the bumper on in Detroit, before they could put the tires on the car in Detroit, the rubber had come from Congo.
That's right.
And the bauxite that went into the aluminum had come from places like Guyana and from places like Guinea in South America and in West Africa. And other parts of that vehicle, you know, came from other places where people were not paid. Not only were they not paid the value of their labor, they were not paid enough to reproduce their capacity to work. So these were factors that when people look at the issue of class, mm-hmm. they have left this out. Or they would say that these are people who are super exploited.